Tonight's reading is taken from Exodus, chapters 5 and 6, and can be found on page 61 of the Church Bibles. Exodus 5 and 6 on page 61. Beginning to read at verse 1. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. Let my people go, so that they may hold a festival to me in the desert." Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Now let us take a 3-day journey into the desert to offer sacrifices to the Lord our God, or he may strike us with plagues or with the sword." But the king of Egypt said, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to your work." Then Pharaoh said, "Look, the people of the land are now numerous, and you are stopping them from working." That same day, Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people. "You are no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They are lazy. That is why they are crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the work harder for the men, so that they keep working and pay no attention to lies." Then the slave drivers and the foreman went out and said to the people, "This is what Pharaoh says. I will not give you any more straw. Go and get your own straw wherever you can find it, but your work will not be reduced at all." So the people scattered all over Egypt to gather stubble to use for straw. The slave drivers kept pressing them, saying, "Complete the work required of you for each day, just as when you had straw." The Israelite foremen appointed by Pharaoh's slave drivers were beaten and asked, "Why didn't you meet your quota of bricks yesterday or today as before?" Then the Israelite foreman went and appealed to Pharaoh. "Why have you treated your servants this way? Your servants are given no straw, yet we are told, 'Make bricks.' Your servants are being beaten, but the fault is with your own people." Pharaoh said, "Lazy, that's what you are, lazy. That is why you keep saying, 'Let us go and sacrifice to the Lord.' Now get to work. You will not be given any straw, yet you must produce your full quota of bricks." The Israelite foreman realized they were in trouble when they were told, "You're not to reduce the number of bricks required of you for each day." When they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "O Lord, why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble upon this people, and you have not rescued your people at all." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country." God also said to Moses, "I am the Lord. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, but by my name, the Lord, I did not make myself known to them. I also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, where they lived as aliens. Moreover, I have heard the groaning of the Israelites, whom the Egyptians are enslaving, and I have remembered my covenant. Therefore, say to the Israelites, 'I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them, and I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people, and I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they did not listen to him because of their discouragement and cruel bondage. Then the Lord said to Moses, Go, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of his country. But Moses said to the Lord, If the Israelites will not listen to me, why would Pharaoh listen to me, since I speak with faltering lips?
Thank you very much, and welcome back to our series of studies on the book of Exodus. A reminder as we begin of where we find ourselves. At the beginning of the book, the people of God, the people to whom God has committed himself as their God, they find themselves doing time in Egypt, slaves to a ruthless dictator Pharaoh. By chapter 12, they're on the move from Egypt, leaving their chains behind after 430 years of oppression, and they're on their way to a new life in a new homeland. And in the bit that was just read, we've come to the bit in the account shortly before that exodus or that going out from Egypt. And in this section that was read, two vital lessons are being taught. Two vital lessons. The central character you'll have picked up in this bit, and indeed in the book as a whole, is Moses. And it's with him that we're going to begin this evening as we look at lesson one. Okay, so lesson one. But firstly, I want you to imagine that you were directing a play which was dramatizing the Exodus events. What sort of person would you cast in the role of Moses? Well, the other week I switched on the television set and I found the screen filled by that colossus of a man, Charlton Heston, his barrel chest blotting out the light of the sun, as he strode around the set of the Hollywood epic, The Ten Commandments. I think Charlton Heston as Moses is actually pretty good casting. Because the man that we come across in, say, chapter 2, if you go back to that, is that sort of stature of a man. By this stage in chapter 2, he's a 40-year-old guy who, the New Testament tells us, has been educated in all the wisdom of the Egyptians, and he was powerful in speech and in action. And in chapter 2, verse 12, you see, for example, he sees one of the Egyptians laying into one of the Israelites. And Moses doesn't just slink off, you know, not wanting to get involved. What he does is he takes matters into his own hands and he kills the guy. He comes across as the sort of chap that you'd feel safe to have with you in the Packhorse pub on a Friday night. I mean, he's that sort of guy. But what he maybe thought was going to be the beginning of overthrowing the oppressors turned out to be the beginning of a downward spiral for him, which would bring him to his knees. And it's worth us just following this through for a few moments, that downward spiral, because it is so significant. So word gets around in chapter 2 about what he's done. His own people turn against him. Pharaoh is after him. And in fear, Moses runs away. This failure evidently shook him to the core, and it stayed with him. Because he spends the next 40 years surviving as a shepherd, and when God appears to him at the end of that time and says he is sending him to Pharaoh to lead the Israelites out of Egypt, Moses' reply in chapter 3, verse 11, betrays a real crisis of self-confidence. Chapter 3, verse 11, Moses says, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? Who am I? And in chapter 4, verse 10, he starts trotting out very lame excuses. Oh Lord, I've never been very eloquent, neither in the past nor since you've spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue. The full extent of this crisis of self-confidence emerges in verse 13. Of chapter 4. O Lord, please send someone else to do it. please send someone else. Moses, the hero, powerful in speech and action, is now a Moses painfully aware of his weakness and his inadequacy. Now, what do you need in that sort of situation? What you need is something to boost your self-confidence. Something which will help you to believe in yourself again. Isn't that what you'd need if you're in that situation? Well, what happens? The Lord persuades Moses to go and to confront Pharaoh. And that's where we find ourselves at the start of the reading in chapter 5. It's clearly a big moment for the man Moses. But all credit to him, in he goes with his brother Aaron, and he lays it on the line with Pharaoh in chapter 5, verse 1. This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, "Let my people go." Well, it's a good start. Straight to the point, firm, clear. Pharaoh can't believe his ears. "Who is the Lord," he says in verse 2, "that I should obey him and let Israel go? I don't know the Lord, and I won't let Israel go." So in so many words, Pharaoh just tells them to push off. And when Moses and his brother try to explain, all they do is to make matters worse. Pharaoh now is hopping mad. So in verse 4, "Moses and Aaron, why are you taking the people away from their labor? Get back to work." All that comes of this little meeting is that the oppression of the people is moved up a few gears. Well, in the state he was in, it was probably the last thing that Moses needed. When you're just picking yourself off the ground, after 40 years of feeling inadequate, the last thing you want is a ruthless dictator landing on top of you, but that's what he gets. Now, by this stage, Moses was undoubtedly wishing that he hadn't got out of bed. But worse was to come. In verse 15 of chapter 5, the Israelite foremen send a delegation to Pharaoh to try and repair the damage. All that comes of it is the realization that Moses really has landed them in it. So in verse 20, when they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them. And they said, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you. You have made us a stench to Pharaoh and his officials, and you've put a sword in their hands to kill us." So now Moses has the leaders of his own people telling him to push off, as well as Pharaoh. It's hardly the confidence booster that he would have wanted. And to add insult to injury, in chapter 6, verse 9, now the Israelite people won't give him the time of day. They did not listen to him because of their discouragement and their cruel bondage. At the end of this day, once again, the wounds of inadequacy and weakness have been opened wide. And when the Lord tells him to go back to Pharaoh, this time Moses has had enough. And in verse 12 of chapter 6, Moses says to the Lord, "Look, if the Israelites will not listen to me, why should Pharaoh listen to me, since I speak with faltering lips?" As far as Moses is concerned, that is it. It is game over. He's had enough. He is a broken man. He has been brought to his knees. His questions to the Lord at the end of chapter 5 are hardly surprising. What would your reaction be in that sort of situation? 5 verse 22, "O Lord, why? Why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me?" Well, those are fair questions, aren't they? Why? What on earth is the Lord up to here? Well, do you see what is going on? What is going on is that Moses has been driven by the Lord to the edge of despair, together with the rest of the people of God. Humanly speaking, there is no hope at all. All the options have now been exhausted. The people are helpless, discouraged, resigned. The foremen are helpless. There's nothing that they can do to stand in the way of Pharaoh. Moses is helpless. His weakness and his inadequacy have been painfully exposed. He's out of his depth. There's nothing he can do. If any glimmers of self-confidence had been flickering in him, they have now been extinguished. At no point has the prospect of deliverance seemed such an impossibility as it does now. Never has it seemed more remote than this. Never has their weakness been so exposed. Well, that is lesson one, human weakness. Lesson one, human weakness. What then is lesson two? Chapter 6, verse 1, Then the Lord said to Moses, now you will see what I will do to Pharaoh. Because of my mighty hand, he will let them go. Because of my mighty hand, he will drive them out of his country. And what follows in this situation of total despair and human helplessness is a declaration of supreme confidence and supreme certainty in verse 6 of chapter 6. Therefore say to the Israelites, I am the Lord, and I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment. I will take you as my own people. I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. And I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession. I am the Lord. You see the emphasis? What supreme confidence and certainty. I am the Lord. I will do it. Lesson one, human weakness. Lesson two, divine strength. Divine strength. By the time the rescue took place, there was no mistaking who was responsible for it. Their human weakness was being driven home again and again and again so that they would recognize their total dependence on the Lord and on his strength. That's how the two lessons fit together. Human weakness, divine strength. It was against this dark backdrop of human weakness that the diamond of divine strength would shine all the brighter. They had to be brought to the point of seeing that this rescue could not come from themselves. It had to come from the Lord. It was as if the Lord was saying, come on then, have a go. Give it a shot. Give it your best shot. See what you can do. Okay, have another go. And it's only when the people are lying exhausted and in despair that the Lord says, okay, now I will show you. What you cannot do, I will do. It's not that they were almost there and they just needed a helping hand or they needed a leg up. They were nowhere near. If you like, they were staring at a brick wall and they were firing a pea shooter at it. And they were running up and headbutting it. And it's as if at the end of their tether, they hear a noise behind them and they look around and there's the Lord on top of a chieftain tank saying, have you had enough? Okay, stand aside and let me have a go. Now watch this. End of wall. The point could not have been clearer that they in their weakness were totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. So that is the truth which comes through all this loud and clear. That is why the Lord takes Moses and the people to the brink of despair so that there would be no mistaking that they in their weakness were totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. But notice it was a truth. It was a truth they would need to hold on to in the years that followed and in the generations that succeeded generation. Because this principle would be the watermark on every subsequent page of their history. It was a thread which ran through all of God's subsequent dealings with them as his people, as he took them from the land of Egypt to the land of promise and established them there. They in their weakness were totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. You see, it's not as if he rescues them from Egypt with his divine strength and then he says, right, I think you should be able to manage now on your own. That's the hard bit done. The promised land is sort of over in that direction. Off you go, you can do it. He doesn't say that. Remember the declaration in chapter 6. I will bring you out. I will take you as my own people. I will bring you to the land. I will give it to you. It wasn't just at the beginning, but rather from first to last. They in their weakness were totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. If they'd been into making their own t-shirts, they could have printed t-shirts with this principle written on the back and on the front. And it would have been appropriate for them to wear these t-shirts coming out of Egypt over the next 40 years, handing these t-shirts on to the next generation and then the next generation. Though by that stage the t-shirts would have been rather unpleasant, and I guess making a new batch would have been a good idea. But anyway, it would have read on the front, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. That is the principle. Now you might be thinking that this is all very well and good, but it is rather remote from us and from our lives here in late 20th century London. How do we build a bridge from then to now? From there to here? How do we build a bridge across? Well, it's really very simple in that there isn't a bridge to build. Because through these events in history, God is revealing truths about himself, and he is revealing principles about his dealings with people. Circumstances may be different, but these truths and principles do not change, because God does not change. So you see, we're not to treat the whole thing as a big allegory, that is to say, a tale in which each detail is symbolic and stands for something. It's not as if each event, each place, each detail symbolizes something, stands for something else, has a hidden meaning. As if in the Old Testament narrative, Egypt equals this, and Pharaoh stands for that, and Moses is a picture of this, and the Israelite foreman represents such and such. We're not intended to read it like that. There aren't such neat one-to-one correlations. Now, in places where the New Testament does attribute some symbolic significance, obviously we're to run with that. That is right. But it is not a license to speculate about all the other details. So rather, through these real events in history, the Lord is revealing truths about himself and principles about how he deals with people. So what is the principle here? The principle we've seen is, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. That is the principle. In the end, though, I mean, the Bible is not about political liberation. The Bible is about salvation. Maybe you know that verse in 2 Timothy that says, about the value of the Bible, it says, the scriptures are able to make you wise about salvation. Not about political liberation. So the Bible is about salvation. That is to say, it is about God rescuing people from the kingdom of darkness for the kingdom of his Son. It's about how through Jesus he rescues people from judgment for relationship with himself forever. So what this is saying to us is, in salvation, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. That is the principle here for us. From beginning to end, salvation is from the Lord. It's not from us. This principle then is fundamental to becoming a Christian. If you're someone who would say that you wouldn't yet acknowledge the Lord as your God, it is vital to see that this is the only way into that relationship. The door that opens into genuine Christian experience has this written on it. In salvation, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. And the door only opens when both points are recognized. Our weakness and our total dependence on the Lord for rescue. Now that first point, our weakness, is a very bitter pill to swallow, isn't it? Humanly speaking, I am helpless. I cannot save myself. Well, that is very different to what religion says. Because religion tells me that I can do it. All we need are disciplines to give us strength, fasting, church going, charity. These disciplines will strengthen you, so you can save yourself. Or so says religion. But the truth is, that is like firing a pea shooter at a brick wall. So that's what religion says. Our pride tells us that we're strong enough. Our pride says, pull yourself together. What are you talking about? What do you mean you cannot get to heaven? Are you a wimp or something? Where's your backbone? I mean, look at this guy, Hempelman Adams, or whatever his name was. Did he just give up and give in to weakness? If he can drag himself to the North Pole with 5 tons of equipment on a sledge, why can't you get yourself to heaven? What's the matter with you? Or our pride says, look at this guy, Christopher Reeves. I mean, did Superman give up when he was paralyzed? No, he lives his life by the slogan of that stricken Apollo 13 mission. Failure is not an option. Well, what's the matter with you? This admission of weakness, of our helplessness, is a difficult thing, isn't it? It is particularly hard for people who are successful. The successful person, the person who has done well in life, the person who is professionally and socially competent, who is a high achiever, who gobbles up problems for breakfast, such a person will inevitably find it galling to have to admit that finally they've met their match and they're helpless and they cannot produce their own solution. And that in the one area of life which ultimately matters. But it is the only way. Maybe that is why the gospel gains a more immediate acceptance by people who in the world's eyes have not made it, and who don't cope so easily with life in general. I suppose for such people, admission of weakness and failure is not a big step. It's a step that has been taken many times before in other areas of life. Now, the gospel is for all. It's for the successful, it's for the unsuccessful. It doesn't matter. But we all have to surrender our self-confidence when it comes to salvation. We have to face up to our helplessness. And some people find that more difficult than others. It's not an end in itself, though. This recognition of weakness has then to be followed by putting our trust in the Lord and in His strength. Putting our trust in what He has done to rescue us in Jesus. Not trusting in ourselves, but trusting in the Lord and His rescue. That is how the Christian life begins. Such a personal response opens the door into genuine Christian experience. Now, for those of us who have gone through that door, the principle does, of course, still apply. The principle still applies. In that respect, nothing has changed. In salvation, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord and on His strength. Salvation is the whole package, isn't it? It is the whole package of getting a person from this world to heaven. That is what salvation is. Salvation is not just the initial bit, the conversion bit. Our salvation is from the Lord from first to last. We have been saved. We are being saved. We will be saved by the Lord. So, the weakness and the helplessness, which we confessed on becoming Christian a year ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, that weakness is as real today as it was then, isn't it? That weakness is as real today as it was then. In ourselves, we don't have the strength to live as Christians for a single day. Just think for a moment of the powers that are ranged against us as believers. You've got the classic trio of society, self, and Satan. So the power of society is too much for us. The world going its own way is a current which is so powerful that in ourselves we would be swept downstream in an instant, given our weakness. The power of the self is too much for us. Our sinful nature with its desires and its thoughts would overwhelm us within an hour given our weakness. The power of Satan is too much for us. The devil, we're told, prowls around like a roaring lion. We in ourselves are too weak to resist him for a moment. In ourselves, we don't have the strength to live as Christians for a single day. We are totally dependent on the Lord and his strength, just as we were when we first believed. It is his mighty hand which keeps us and sustains us and will see our salvation through to the end. Of course it is. Now that's not to say that we sit back and we do nothing, but it is to say that whatever we do would have no effect if it weren't for the fact that the Lord is protecting us and watching over us and fighting for us constantly, every day, every night, every hour, every moment. And it's just as well. It's just as well that he is, or we wouldn't make it. But one of the glorious privileges of being the people of God is that he commits himself to saving us. And that means seeing the work through from the beginning to the end, to completion. That's because this principle runs through the Christian life. It's because of that that praying and praising are such appropriate activities for us in the everyday. Because in both those things, in praying and in praising, what are we doing? Well, we're recognizing that in our weakness, we are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. So in prayer, we're acknowledging our weakness and we're asking for his strength. And in praising, we're giving thanks to the Lord for all that he's done and all that he is doing and all that he will do for us. In salvation, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in his strength. That is the principle which is printed on the t-shirt of every true believer. I would be surprised, though, if I was the only person here who felt the temptation at times to wear a jumper on top of the t-shirt and to cover it up. Why? Well, because of the weakness bit. Because of the weakness bit. Because it is one thing to admit that you were weak and were helpless when the Lord saved you 10, 20 years ago. That's one thing. It's another thing to admit that you still are just as weak and helpless in yourself now as you are being saved and taken to heaven. That admission does not get any easier, does it? So our pride tells us, come on, surely you're strong enough now. Pull yourself together. Can't you manage on your own now, after all these years? Surely now you've got the measure of the old enemies. Society, the self, Satan. How long do you need? Surely you've learned enough now to stand on your own two feet. Look at Hembleman Adams. Look at Christopher Reeves. Failure is not an option. You can't admit weakness, helplessness. Not now. Where's your self-respect? That's what our pride tells us. To keep recognizing our weakness, our helplessness, our total dependence on the Lord, that is bound to be more difficult for successful people, isn't it? It is bound to be more difficult, as it was at conversion, for those who've done well in life, for the professionally and the socially competent, for the high achiever, for the person who gobbles up problems for breakfast. Such people will inevitably find it galling to have to keep on admitting that they are weak and spiritually unable to cope in themselves. I think if we are such people, one of the symptoms will be, that we'll find we are reluctant to admit our weakness to one another. So we'll feel a bit embarrassed and ashamed and think that we're letting the side down if we admit weakness to one another. Do you ever find that sometimes? Even with good friends. That even with good friends, you give what you think is the right answer rather than what is the real answer. So we give what we think is the encouraging response. So for example, if someone says, a good friend says to you, how are things going at the moment? We say, oh, well, everything's fine. Yeah, everything's fine. I'm really encouraged. Now, it's not to say that is never true, but why do we sometimes say that when what we're thinking is, I'm really feeling the pressure. The pull of temptation is enormous at the moment. And I really messed up yesterday. And Bible reading and prayer, I'm finding a bit of a struggle at the moment. And my thought life is a battleground. But praise the Lord, He has given me strength to keep going, and I rejoice in that. But please pray for me. I really need it, especially in this area. What is it that keeps us at times from giving that answer, the second answer? Well, it may be pride. Pride wanting to maintain an image of competence and success. But that isn't what being a Christian is about. That doesn't fit the basic principle. We're not to be models of self-competence and self-confidence. We're to be models of the Lord's strength in our weakness. Or it could be that we don't want to discourage the other person. Of course, ironically, nothing is more discouraging than the pat answer of all is fine. Because the other person is thinking, help, but maybe it's just me. I better keep this one to myself. Yeah, I'm just fine too. The honest answer is actually more encouraging, isn't it? It's encouraging to hear someone admit their weakness and the fact that they are looking to the Lord in His strength and they are being sustained. That is more encouraging. Now, this isn't about hanging out our dirty washing the whole time, is it? It's about just being real with one another. It could be sometimes that we feel the second answer is not being a good role model for other people. It's not being a good example. Especially if we're leaders, maybe if you're a leader of a small group or whatever. Though, of course, the opposite is true. As leaders, we should be the ones who are wearing the t-shirt with pride for all to see. As it proclaims, in salvation from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in His strength. The Apostle Paul certainly wore it. The letter of 2 Corinthians is full of examples of this principle, as it is seen in his life. The Lord's strength made perfect in his weakness. Well, whatever the reason, we are not to be ashamed of our weakness. Because supremely our weakness takes the glory away from us and it gives it to the one to whom it belongs. The one to whom all the credit should go for our salvation from first to last. It confirms the reality of the song that they sing in the book of Revelation, which says, salvation belongs to our God. Praise and glory and thanks and power be to our God forever and ever. It is a truth which is liberating for us, and it is glorifying for God. In salvation, from first to last, we in our weakness are totally dependent on the Lord in His strength. Well, we're going to pause for a few moments for personal reflection and prayer before William continues to lead us.